Case number 12-5156 et al. El Paso Natural Gas Company Appellant, Navajo Nation v. United States of America. Mr. Newman for Appellant El Paso Natural Gas Company, Mr. Fry for Appellant Navajo Nation, and Mr. Gray for Appellees.
Shall I begin? Good morning, and may it please the Court. Chris Newman on behalf of Appellant El Paso Natural Gas Company. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The principal issue in this case is whether after 2 decades of acknowledged RCRA violations...
Counsel, I have to ask at the outset, my colleagues will be amused, I'm sure. Are you not aware of our rules that strongly urge you not to use acronyms in briefs?
Your Honor, thank you. Yes, I understand. The Tuba City Open Dump has been used in much of the correspondence below as TCOD. I'll refer to it as the dump here.
We're bound to whatever you do in the district court. Is that what you're saying?
We thought this would be helpful for the court in parsing the record where that's the reference.
So you didn't follow our rule. I mean, your brief is replete with acronyms that are impossible to remember. You could use the word dump. It's so easy.
Your Honor is exactly right. It is a dump,
don't you understand? It's very hard reading briefs when you have all these acronyms that you have to constantly go back on. It's a conceit of law students now. They do it more and more and more, but it's so aggravating.
I'm very sorry, Your Honor.
You shouldn't have gotten him going on this.
All right. The principal issue in this case is whether after 2 decades of acknowledged RCRA violations and 32 studies at the Tuba City Open Dump, or the dump, the government may perform a 33rd study, now purportedly under the authority of CERCLA, and seek to halt appellants' previously filed RCRA claims forever. This case presents a novel issue, and the government cites to only one district court opinion in support of its position. But that case didn't examine the many important issues here in this case, and it's distinguishable. El Paso and the Navajo Nation seek their day in court. After 2 decades and 33 studies, it's time for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to comply with RCRA at the open dump. For 4 reasons, El Paso asked the court to hold that its RCRA claims are not barred by Section 113H of CERCLA. First, CERCLA and its 113H bar do not apply to naturally occurring substances. Second, the government offers no objective indicator with any reasonable target dates for completion of any remedial action at the dump, and therefore El Paso's RCRA claims are not barred by Section 113H. Third, El Paso, with its previously filed RCRA claims, did not seek to challenge any removal action taken by the government. The purpose of Section 113H is to bar lawsuits initiated after the government starts a response at a site to avoid the delay of the cleanup activities. That is not the case that we have here. And finally, El Paso seeks to enforce the RCRA program at the dump. Citizens and the tribe, as a citizen, are the only parties that can enforce the solid waste requirements of RCRA. Congress was careful and clear in delineating that authority, and the 113H language does not act as a bar to appellants' claims. As an initial matter, the record here is clear. The government has issued a detailed and thorough report attached to its settlement agreement, the Remedial Investigation and Feasibility Study, and its findings are that this is a solid waste dump. The government was right for 20 years in regulating this dump under RCRA. It has found no hazardous waste. It has found no source of any radioactive waste. And it has found only naturally occurring materials. The government argues that the court can't even perform a preliminary analysis to determine if there are any non-naturally occurring materials. But this isn't right. This court did just that in the Atomic Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers case when it looked to see whether certain recycling activities were part of a removal action taken by the government. In order for the 113H bar to apply, Section 104 must be triggered, and Section 104 relies upon the release of a hazardous substance and excludes specifically any naturally occurring substance. Here, the government's own report establishes that all the waste in the dump is naturally occurring solid waste, and Section 104 is never triggered, and therefore the Section 113H bar does not act to bar El Paso's RCRA claims here.
I think I understand your argument, but isn't the argument that you're making now somewhat inconsistent with your initial position? In other words, saying now that this is naturally occurring.
No, Your Honor. We argued the same position below, and the fact is that since we filed this case in 2007,
my recollection is your complaint was based on the exact opposite proposition.
No, Your Honor, in 2007, El Paso was approached by the Navajo Nation with allegations that its waste from sites at or near the mill, the uranium mill, made their way to the open dump. Based on the facts that we had presented from the Navajo, there was solid waste, potentially hazardous waste, and potentially radioactive waste. And as a result, we alleged in our complaint in the alternative that those wastes existed and could be addressed either under UMTRCA, a claim which the court earlier dismissed, or RCRA at issue here.
What is UMTRCA?
Yes, Your Honor, sorry. Uranium Mill Tailing Radiation Control Act. And
is that the statute that the government refers to as the Tailings Act?
The Tailings Act, yes, Your Honor. The government bears the burden here to show that there is non-naturally occurring hazardous waste at the dump, and it hasn't done it. This case is similar to another case we cite, Otati and Goss, where the government has a government witness in a report say that certain arsenic waste is consistent with background, and the trial court agrees and doesn't extend CERCLA authority in that case. That's what we ask here is that the court find the court below was wrong in not proceeding to examine the type of waste, whether in fact a 104 removal action was triggered, and thus implicating the 113H bar. In addition, as the Seventh Circuit points out in the Fry decision, 113H is not an open-ended prohibition on citizen suits. The government must have some objective indicator of when a remedy will be performed at the site, and here there's been none. Four times since 1992, the government has made statements that it would perform a cleanup. It's welched every time, and here it's already a year past the deadline for the very report that was the subject of the settlement agreement on which the government argues our claims are barred.
The analysis in Fry actually makes sense, but it's that language is not in 113H. Right. I mean, you know, are you asking us to read that into the statute?
Your Honor,
there are some circuits to do things like that loosely, but we try to restrain ourselves.
Well, the purpose of Section 113 is to bar challenges to then existing EPA actions. Here we have none.
Yeah, but the timetable argument, I want to make sure I understand your naturally occurring substances argument, because you're essentially arguing that the relief under RCRA is broader than the remediation plan, and therefore the district court should not have dismissed. That is, am I understanding you correctly? You're saying it's broader than any remediation plan because a remediation plan doesn't go to naturally occurring substances and your RCRA claim does.
Your Honor, that is one issue, in fact, is that we argue this in our enforcement argument that we're entitled to enforce, and that is Part 258 applies cradle to grave to a dump, and among other things, it requires that groundwater monitoring and certain interim measures be taken, and by regulation, those must be consistent with any final remedy. There can be no conflict, which is the point you're getting to. And if there can be no conflict, then under the case law, we would state a possible claim on the face of our complaint that we're entitled to relief. We ask for something that's not in conflict with anything that the government is doing. El Paso also argues that its earlier filed RCRA claims did not present any challenge to the government's study. El Paso urges the plain meaning of the word any challenges in Section 113H. A challenge necessarily requires an object. But when El Paso filed its RCRA citizen suit claims in 2007, the government had taken no study and there was nothing to challenge. The cases relied upon by the government focus on the verb tense of the word challenge, but that's not the tense Congress used here. Congress prohibited in 113H any challenges to a removal action taken under Section
114. Why is it challenging now?
Your Honor, respectfully, we believe that a challenge has to be determined at the time the claim is filed. That's the only way
You could theoretically have jurisdiction in the district court and lose it in the court of appeals, could you?
But we don't think, Your Honor, that the plain language of 113H permits that reading in the sense that it prohibits any challenges.
Aren't you making a challenge now?
Well, using the verb tense, the government argued.
Are you calling it a verb or a noun? Aren't you making a challenge now?
I would argue no, Your Honor, inasmuch as I pointed out in response to Judge Edwards' question, we seek relief that doesn't in fact challenge, seek something.
Well, that's a different argument. I mean, that's why I'm trying to understand whether your argument is that your relief under RCRA is clearly broader than the remediation plan, than anything the remediation plan would involve. They're not coterminous. And then it seems to me you have a viable argument that 113 shouldn't be in play. And there's something for the district court to consider. Because if not, you have a problem because, you know, anything a district court would otherwise do would be disruptive of what the government remediation plan is. You don't want the district court fooling around with any kind of injunction. But if you're saying remediation plan is there, we understand, otherwise there's no jurisdiction, but what we are claiming is not coterminous with what anything they're doing in that remediation plan. Is that what you're saying? That is because of the natural occurring substances. And the remediation plan is not going to touch natural occurring substances. Is that your argument? The remediation plan doesn't touch it, or it does? I'm trying to understand, because otherwise you have a problem.
Your Honor,
remediation
plan...
Is the government going to be able to viably argue that the remediation plan would also include naturally occurring substances?
The remediation plan at issue coming out of their study?
No, but the remediation plan that will block you under 113.
Right. So the government has performed a study, a remedial investigation feasibility study, which requires as its authority that there be a non-naturally occurring release.
See, what I'm trying to ask you is, I thought you were trying to say that there's no circular authority with respect to naturally occurring substances.
That's right. That's
all you're wanting to get at here is naturally occurring substances, and that's RCRA.
That's exactly right,
and
Your Honor.
So 113 shouldn't come into play.
That's right.
Maybe I'm not speaking clearly, but that's what I'm trying to ask.
So are you saying that 113H can't be triggered because there's no no circular, right? Because these occurred naturally. Or are you saying that your RCRA action is broader than what EPA and BIA are trying to do?
I think both, Your Honor. I mean, we do say the government bears the burden that seeks to establish an exception to the court's jurisdiction by saying that it has authority to take a 104 action, that we're challenging that, and therefore the 113H bar applies. It hasn't met that burden because its own study makes only a finding that there are naturally occurring materials, no hazardous waste, solid waste. The government doesn't take the bait and point to any hazardous substance. It just says the court can't even look at that challenge. You can't perform a preliminary analysis as you did an oil, chemical,
but
and
your argument is, and there's what you want to get at is not about what CERCLA addresses.
That's right, Your Honor. The RCRA Part 258 requirements are there for health and the environment. operating and dumps going through closure have to comply with these requirements. And here that compliance is entirely consistent with what the government's study might be doing. And the study, by the way, we're 3 years into a study. I'm not exactly sure what interference or conflict there could possibly be. But by regulation, under Part 258, the relief we seek must not interfere with anything the government wants to do by way of final remedy. There can be no conflict, and therefore there's no interference. El Paso also argues that under the Tenth Circuit's decision in Colorado, it's entitled to enforce RCRA, notwithstanding a CERCLA action. And the government argues and is wrong that Colorado turned on a question of state law. That's not the case. Colorado was enforcing a delegated, federally enforceable program. The Tenth Circuit even points out Colorado could have done this under the very citizen suit provision we urge here. It had issued an order for compliance, and it sought to enforce that order. That provision on enforcing orders is the same under Colorado law and federal law, and it could have been enforced either way. What's important is the court looked at how to harmonize RCRA and CERCLA and applied principles of statutory construction. That an earlier specific provision in RCRA allowing citizen suits even when certain CERCLA actions are taken is not trumped by a later general CERCLA prohibition that doesn't even mention RCRA and is not specific. But otherwise, the court would be finding RCRA and its provisions were repealed by implication. And finally, the government seeks to bring a RCRA citizen suit on behalf of the Bureau of Indian Affairs against El Paso. And El Paso argues this is not permitted. EPA has authority to address solid waste disposal that presents an endangerment. It has not declared an endangerment here. Congress carefully delineated the federal government's authority to enforce provisions of RCRA. The federal government may not enforce the solid waste compliance requirements. Only citizens through citizen suits and the tribe here through its citizen suit can do that. And the government's...
They dropped that claim. District court dismissed it without prejudice. So what do you want us to say should be with prejudice?
As a matter of law, they were not entitled to bring that claim. It should have been dismissed.
It was dismissed. But it was dismissed without prejudice.
Right. It should be with prejudice, Your Honor.
I mean, why should we fool with that if it's gone and leave it for another day? You'd rather have us just say it should have been with prejudice.
The trial court...
I'm not saying you can't raise that now. I just want to know what you worry.
Right. The trial court made a separate minute order finding on this. And in our view, there's no need to revisit the issue. It was ripe for decision. And as a matter of law, that claim is prohibited. It should be dismissal with prejudice. Thank you.
It pleases the court. I'm Paul Fryer, representing the Navajo Nation. I'd like to begin with a preemptive mea culpa. I have obviously many acronyms in my brief, and I apologize to the court for that. I'd like to follow up just a little bit on what was just said before getting into the Navajo-specific arguments. First, I'd like to look at the language of Section 113H, not from a noun standpoint necessarily of the word challenge, but from the verb tense. The section is entitled Timing of Review, and so verb tenses should mean something. And we agree with El Paso that the prior filed RCRA action can't be a challenge under 113H because it says you can't challenge an order issued ED, past tense, or a remedial action selected ED, past tense. There hasn't been a remedial action selected yet. What we have now is only the 33rd study over 21 years of an open dump that is exceeding EPA standards for its groundwater in selenium, arsenic, radium, total dissolved solids, and its uranium content is 10 times that of the surrounding groundwater. This case is about groundwater. And by the way, not only, Judge Edwards, does the type of solid waste that we're trying to get rid of there, including medical waste from the Indian Health Service, needles, syringes, and medical vials, you'll find that at the Joint Appendix at page 400. CERCLA itself says in section 9620I, CERCLA shall not affect or impair the obligation of a department or agency of the United States to comply with RCRA. They're totally compatible in this context, especially given the findings of the newly completed RIFS. But from the Navajo Nation standpoint, this case is about groundwater. The Navajo Nation, if you've been there, is a desert. But there is some prime agricultural land. This happens to be it, and that's at page, I believe, 426 of the Joint Appendix. So the Indian Agricultural Resource Management Act does come into play, and that requires the government to expressly requires the government to follow tribal law, and it's, it specifies tribal environmental laws. Well, the Navajo Nation has a body of law, including the Navajo Clean Water Act, that's fashioned after the Federal Clean Water Act, and we have discharges from the mill, from the Highway 160 site, and from the Tuba City open dump. And those are all contributing to groundwater pollution of the most important aquifer for the Navajo Nation and the Hopi tribe. It's called the Navajo Aquifer or the N Aquifer. And there are plumes coming from each of these locations, except we don't know what's coming from the Highway 160 site. So going to, I think, our hardest argument, is what did we release? We signed releases in the 160 Amendment, and we signed a release in the 1985 Cooperative Agreement. Well, it's clear, at least to me, that we didn't release anything having to do with groundwater at the Highway 160 site. And the reason I say that is because the scope of work for that project and that amendment dealt only with things like volumes to be removed, excavation, soils and waste, hauling, backfilling. That's
well,
all.
If you just read the release, it doesn't give you your interpretation, does it?
Well, no, it does. There is. It just refers back to the earlier release, and that earlier release does support us, I think, Your Honor. It says it releases the United States concerning the, and I'm quoting now, the performance of any remedial action on such mill site. So what is the remedial action in the Highway 160 context? It's all of this soils-related work, and there's ample evidence that it doesn't include the groundwater component. And what I would look at would be the, you know, follow the money. Joint Appendix at page 422, quote, the Navajo Nation shall continue to submit annual budgets for the groundwater compliance portion of the agreement. Well, this obviously isn't the groundwater compliance portion of the agreement. That's separate. And if you look at the budget itself on page 329 of the Joint Appendix, you have different columns. There's a GW column. That's groundwater, and they have a whole bunch of numbers there. And they have another budget for some other project. And then they have Highway 160 on a separate column, $4.5 million. Everything is in that component. There's nothing over here.
So you're saying that the waiver did not waive anything with respect to non-Mill Tailings Act claims?
I'm saying it didn't waive anything that respects groundwater.
Well, wait, we got to put it somewhere. We have to put it somewhere. Non-Mill Tailings Act claims, those were not waived. Is that what you're saying? Because the waiver says, I mean, I understand some of your argument, the government leaves out part of the waiver. The waiver says pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 7915.
Yes.
That's all the way.
That's it. Start. That's yes.
That's mill tailings, right?
That is correct.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. So you're saying that you didn't sign anything that waived matters that were non-mill tailings matters.
Absolutely
and
correct.
And waiver cannot be read that way.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was amazed that the government left that language out when they cited it, but whatever.
Okay.
So what are we talking about then?
So I think what we're talking about in both the statute and the precise waiver.
Where is your cause of action that has not been waived with respect to where are you now? You're not in mill tailings because you waived that. So where are you?
We're in groundwater at Highway 60.
No, I understand. But what statute? Where's your cause of action?
Okay.
You're not in mill tailings because you waived it. So where are you?
Okay, we're under, at Highway 160, we're under the American Indian Agricultural Resource Management Act that requires the federal government to comply with tribal environmental laws.
Indian Agricultural Act?
Yes.
But there's an express sovereign immunity there.
That's correct.
Right.
Sovereign
so
immunity is waived in the...
It doesn't waive.
No, it is waived in the Administrative Procedures Act. The fact that it's not waived directly there doesn't mean you don't have an APA Act claim.
What's the failure to act under the APA?
The failure to act is the failure to remediate the groundwater plume that
pursuant to the Indian Agricultural Act?
Yes.
But you can't do it. If they haven't waived sovereign immunity with respect to claims under that act, how can you get back to it through the APA?
Because the APA has a separate, independent waiver of sovereign immunity that
failure to act with respect to something where I am not waiving sovereign immunity.
That's correct.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
The Patchak case of the United States Supreme Court, which happens to be an Indian case, there was not a waiver of sovereign immunity under the federal... Quiet Title Act for Indian lands. Court said that's too bad. Even though you're going to get the same relief under the APA, you can sue to invalidate this trust land in the trust.
You have to also focus on a specific action that the government has taken
right.
or not taken, even if you're under APA, don't you?
That's correct. There has to be either an action or a failure to act.
And what is the specific failure to act? And of course, that takes you back. Whether it's sovereign immunity or not, that takes you back to the other statute to figure out what it is, was the specific action the government was required to take.
Well, the government was required under UMTRCA to clean. I'm sorry, the Mill Tailings Act.
That was the one you waived.
You waived it.
No, we only waived the remedial action under UMTRCA that is part of that contract. And that contract did not deal with groundwater. It's expressly separated out groundwater from the physical.
You waived mill tailings. You said pursuant to.
These aren't tailings. This is groundwater.
Well, groundwater is not a statute, is it? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm lost.
No,
groundwater is not a statute. I got to get you in a cause of action somewhere so I understand your argument. You waived the mill tailings causes of action.
No. We waived the mill tailings action to the extent that it was waived in the agreement. And the agreement waived it only to the extent of the physical surface soils elements. It did not waive it with respect to the groundwater. And in fact, the Mill Tailings Act itself requires that the Department of Energy remediate the... even the mill tailings to standards that the Environmental Protection Agency has adopted, and they failed to do that. That's in Section 7915A2, and that then implicates Section 7918. EPA standards are clearly being violated at this mill site. So what I think the waiver involves is it's limited to the medium, soils versus groundwater, and it's limited in time. It's not a waiver for all time for the any unlawful environmental contamination that we experience after the DOE is done with our property. It's a waiver that deals with the manner in which DOE has conducted that remedial activity when they're on our property. And that comports, I think, Your Honors, with the express consideration of the scope of the waiver by the Congress. The House committee looked at the broad waiver that was offered by the administration and it said, no, we're not going to go with that broad waiver. We're going to go with a more limited waiver. What did that broad waiver say? It was limited in time to the period of time when DOE was on site doing activities. It was it did not, even the administration's broad proposed waiver and release provision, even that didn't permit DOE to walk away for all time and not worry about the environmental contamination that an improper selection, not performance, but selection of a remedy entails. And what we're really talking about here is an improper selection of a remedy under the Mill Tailings Act. They put this, they left this material in an area unlined where all of the rainwater and flood events, the rarer flood events that we have in the monsoon season there, can leach through this, percolate down, and carry more contaminants into the to the groundwater, and that's what's happening. So that wasn't waived, and our view of this, I think, is also.
The waiver says holds the United States harmless against any claim arising out of the performance of any such remedial action.
The performance, not the selection. 7915A2, 7918 all differentiate between selection and performance. We're complaining about the selection of the remedial action that permits this material to remain in an unlined area, allowing percolation of contaminants to continue to contaminate the most precious water asset in this entire region. I see I only have a minute, and I did want to save time for rebuttal, so thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael Gray. I'm here on behalf of the federal appellees. There are three sites in the case, and we think three grounds on which to resolve the case and affirm one at each site. At the dump site, we think 113H bars all the claims. At the Highway 160 site and the mill site, those claims have been released in the separate releases. I'll begin with the dump site and the 113H argument. The primary argument that counsel made, counsel for EPNG made, was about the authority and the naturally occurring issue. Of course, the argument there is that CERCLA does not apply and a removal action would be improper because the materials are naturally occurring, but that itself is a challenge to the removal action under Section 113H, because if you were to agree with that and find that the government lacked authority to undertake the removal action, which is clearly ongoing, then that would set aside that removal action. The government wouldn't have that authority. So that's clearly
a
challenge.
That wouldn't be the remedy. The remedy would be to address the RCRA claim that's being raised. It's not a matter of whether the government has authority to do whatever it wants to do under CERCLA. I don't know how you can have a preemptive, whatever you want to call it, jurisdictional statute that goes to CERCLA claims reach beyond CERCLA. That's all 113 can be dealing with.
Every court, including this one, that's considered that so far has held that CERCLA bars not just CERCLA claims, but any challenge under any other statute. In the oil, chemical, and atomic workers case, this court dismissed a NEPA claim on 113H grounds. At least seven different courts of appeals have dismissed RCRA citizen suit claims on 113H grounds. I think it clearly has extra It applies outside of the context of CERCLA just in its language. It says any challenges to a removal or remedial action in any action. And so I think it clearly bars not just claims under CERCLA or claims under any other statute, but as here, an argument that would challenge the authority to undertake the action is itself a challenge.
But I think what they're saying is you're not addressing their claim. They're not challenging the removal action. Now, they may be wrong on that. You'll have to tell me why, but that's not – yes, you're right. That's what the language says. Whether it reaches beyond CERCLA or not, fine. But that's not what their claim is. They're not challenging the removal action.
But I think
– I hear them saying go ahead and do your removal thing as you want. We're talking about naturally occurring –
But necessarily, any judgment from this court declaring that EPA lacks authority under CERCLA at this site because of materials.
We don't want you to address CERCLA. At least if I were arguing, I don't care what you do. You have your CERCLA authority. Do what you want to do. We are claiming there's a different matter here. It goes to naturally occurring substances, clearly not a CERCLA issue, and we are raising a claim with respect to that, and it will not affect whatever you're doing under CERCLA. We're not challenging what you're doing under CERCLA.
I do not
and
read
the... And as I read the study, just like they say, the government has essentially acknowledged that. We're not dealing with the naturally occurring substances issue.
No, I don't think that's correct. CERCLA applies if you have a release or a threat of release of a hazardous substance. They say there's nothing here because it's naturally occurring, but there's clearly evidence that's cited in the work plan. I mean, there are hazardous substances here. The question is naturally or not. And there's evidence that there's the mill site that residents testified to having seen it. Trucks from the mill site dumping waste. They found balls from the mill site, and that's sufficient to show a threat of release to invoke CERCLA. And I do want to go back to this. The fundamental premise of their argument on naturally occurring is that the government lacks authority to undertake the removal action under CERCLA. And I don't know that they can...
I thought they were suggesting that the government, by acknowledging in at the stage of study that there is, they're not addressing the naturally occurring. They've already said that.
No, they're not... The government is addressing non-naturally occurring substances. If they were naturally occurring substances, then there would be no authority under CERCLA to address it.
Right.
That's a challenge to the removal action that's being undertaken. If this court says these substances are all naturally occurring and there's no...
Why would you have to say all naturally occurring as opposed to saying where there are naturally occurring... There may be many things going on where there are naturally occurring substances.
No, I think if there's non-naturally occurring substances commingled with naturally occurring substances, you clearly have CERCLA authority, and RCRA doesn't add anything. And I think you heard counsel for the tribe say that CERCLA says you have to comply with the RCRA standards, and if you have applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements under that statute, under CERCLA, you have to carry them out. So I don't think RCRA adds anything on top of the CERCLA action here, and the necessary consequence of saying that the government completely lacks authority under CERCLA, which is what you'd have to say to credit their argument, would be a challenge to the removal action, which is barred. But I don't want to get too caught up on that, because I do think that there's plenty sufficient authority here to, as I say, support a threat of release of natural substances and allow them to proceed under CERCLA. And as I said, I don't think RCRA adds anything.
Suppose you had a case where the government specifically said, we do not think there is any hazardous material here that is other than natural. But nevertheless, we're going to treat it under CERCLA.
I still think that it would be a challenge to the authority under CERCLA, and the way you would get around this, let me explain, because I think that it doesn't particularly matter because the goal is to clean up the site. And if the government cleans up a site where only naturally occurring materials, where this would come into play is in a cost recovery action. Against, then you could assert that as a defense and say, no, these aren't proper response costs that we're, as a potentially responsible party, liable for because you undertook an action that you didn't have authority to take.
I'm asking how you interpret the jurisdictional provision.
Yeah, and, well, that's what I'm saying.
In my hypothetical, you would say there would still be a challenge.
It would still be a challenge that at that point, if you brought it that way, it would still be a challenge to the removal action that there would be no jurisdiction over. The way you get that issue in front of the court is through a cost recovery action or through a declaratory judgment action in one of the exceptions in 113H after the action is over. What you don't do is come in and say you have to stop the cleanup because you don't have authority to do that. So we do think that there is a challenge here that is barred by 113H, and that's true not just of RCRA, but to any of the sites, any of the challenges that go to the dump site, because there is clearly an ongoing removal action, and they seek injunctive relief to require cleanup measures that would interfere with the ongoing removal action and then any remedies selected in that.
So in your view, the CERCLA action is indefinite. It doesn't have to have any end point, and the government could do this indefinitely. Is that your argument?
If there is a removal action or a remedial action selected, then there's no jurisdiction over the claim. That's correct. I don't think there's any requirement in the statute for the kind of thing that Fry imposed, but Fry is distinguishable on the ground that there was no selected removal or remedial action.
Fry is distinguishable on its facts, but just generally, this idea that as soon as a CERCLA action commences, then nothing else can happen, and it doesn't matter how long then this takes because. This is the 33rd investigation, right? And if EPA and BIA are not satisfied with what's going on here, they can start over again. They can restructure the way they want to do the investigation. And so your argument is there's nothing in this statute and nothing anyone can do once the CERCLA action commences.
Once you're in the CERCLA world, you're in the CERCLA world. That's right, and that's what Congress provided. It says any challenges in any action, no jurisdiction.
But does that make any sense? I mean, the whole point of saying that, you know, there's no jurisdiction for challenges is because it's based on an assumption that this is going to be done very reasonably expeditiously, right?
That the agencies will perform their duties in accordance with the law. Yes, I think that's a normal presumption. I think Congress was entitled to make it, and it did. And so I'm not sure that that's what Congress chose to do. I do want to turn to the release question at the Highway 160 site. I don't think that release is limited only to the Mill Tailings Act claims. I think it is true that the statutory requirement for the release and the authority, which is recited at the beginning of the release, is the Mill Tailings Act, but the release itself releases the United States of any liability or claim concerning the remedial action or arising out of the performance of the remedial action. So I think the release is broader than just...
I don't know, but the beginning of the sentence says pursuant to Mill Tailings.
I think that's a recitation of the authority for the release, because that statute says you have to require a release, but the statute doesn't say, and the release doesn't say, that the release only applies to claims under the statute, right? The Mill Tailings Act was, hey, we're going to clean this up, and provided the mechanisms and said, would you release any claims? So I don't think that you can limit it to that. But, even if you disagree with that, as you said, the claims they've asserted here all have to be brought under the APA and there are the finality requirements under the APA that haven't been met as to any of those claims.
What do you mean as to any of them? What ones are you talking about?
Well, you have the Indian Agricultural Act.
What's the finality requirement there? I understand Indian Lands Operation Dump Cleanup Act. They haven't exhausted. But what about the Indian Agricultural Act?
Let me make sure I get the exact claims that they've made under that statute. That's the one where the instruction is to simply to comply with the tribal laws, and they've not identified any particular discrete required failure to act on the part of the government. I think the case law is pretty clear that just a general instruction to comply with the law doesn't give rise to a 706-1 claim under the APA if you can't identify discrete legally required action. And so that claim Indian Lands Open Dump Act claim is also subject to those same requirements. There's a general duty to consult and then provide financial and technical assistance, which is subject to the priorities established by the government. So there's no discrete failure to act there either. Unless there are further questions, I think I've addressed everything the other side addressed, and I would ask that you affirm on all three sites.
Thank you. Had a minute remaining. Well, we'll be generous. 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'd just like to quickly address the state of the record and the nature of the waste below. Council argued that a threat of release is enough, but that ignores you still need a hazardous substance. And in the record below, the government points to nothing in its AOC, nothing in the remedial investigation feasibility work plan that identifies any hazardous substance. There's mention of things above Clean Water Act MCLs, but no connecting of dots to indicate how that's a hazardous substance. It's all naturally occurring. The mill balls are solid waste, and if they're not, that's byproduct material. It's material that came from the mill. That's carved out through the Atomic Energy Act exemption to the definition of release, and you need a release of a hazardous substance to trigger 104. So under the government's own arguments, there still is no hazardous substance. It's strictly solid waste here. At the end of the day, this is a RCRA claim. Judge Edwards asked, did CERCLA bar all claims? 113B bars claims relating to controversies arising under CERCLA. Our claim arises under RCRA. It doesn't arise under CERCLA.
What about all the cases that counsel cited?
There's never been a case, save the one River Village case they point to, that has looked at the issue here, and that is...
Well, he cited a number of cases in which other statutes were interpreted as being barred by CERCLA.
Right, and we are unique and distinct from those cases because we're not seeking to challenge any existing government action. Those NEPA claims point to an existing government action. We don't have that here.
That's not relevant to your point, your argument, is it? You're shifting to a different argument.
Yes, those courts never looked at the language in 113B that says it relates to controversies arising under CERCLA, specifically.
So all those courts are wrong.
Well, the issue's never been presented this way because there's never been no one has argued it, and there's never been a case in this posture with 2 decades and 32 studies at a dump. And the last thing is why this matters, why RCRA, even if this is naturally occurring. And the answer is because RCRA requires action on a timeline. It requires it now. There's no excuse for compliance. If we wait for a CERCLA action that may or may not ever occur, we'll never have compliance and we'll continue to have these threats to health and the environment. That's why we should be able to enforce our RCRA claims now. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a minute left.
Thank you. Paul Fry again for the Navajo Nation. Judge Brown, language matters. Language in 113H matters. I think that's why verb tenses matter in 113H. And I would cite to an analogous case under RCRA, the Adkins case, 644, Fed 3rd, and this discussion is at page 493. Same thing, Judge Edwards, with the release. The language matters. And I'd urge a careful parsing of that release. It's for the performance of a remedial action on the mill site. It's not the selection in some architect's office, and it's not the subsequent environmental contamination that occurs after completion of DOE's activities. And Judge Edwards, you ask for what is the basis for our claims. I omitted one very significant one, and that is the federal trust duty. This land is held in an express trust under 25 U.S.C. 640D9. There are statutes in place, including the Open Land Dumps Act and the Agricultural Resource Management Act, that direct the government in how to effectuate this trust responsibility. And the government has exercised not just supervision and control over these assets, they've exercised the power to exclude everybody else from going on the assets. On page 276 of the joint appendix, the BIA area director says that we put a fence around it, and that wasn't good enough. We put razor wire over that fence recently, and they fenced off the mill area too. And in looking at all of these statutes and the agreement between the Navajo Nation and the federal government, if there is any ambiguity, it ought to be resolved in favor of the Navajo Nation. There's some recent scholarship on this called Indian Canon Originalism in this year's Harvard Law Review, starting at page 1100. And we have that type of treaty, that protection type of treaty.
Thank you.